All right, you guys. Welcome to the show. How's it going? It's my show, The Scott Horton Show, here on the Liberty Radio Network. What's the day? Oh, today's the day. It's the 11th. November 11th. Veterans Day. When we celebrate the lives of those who are lucky enough to make it home from the foreign wars the government sent them off to. AKA Armistice Day. Used to be a holiday when Americans celebrated the end of a war. The end of a war. The Great War. World War One. And, it was, how would you like to be the last man to die on the 11th day, the 11th hour, the 10th minute? Before the ceasefire kicks in. Oh, but everybody at the table agreed that it would be really neat if it was all ones, you know? Instead of just calling it quits right then. Let's let them fight through the 11th until it ends at 11:11, and then wouldn't that be cool? They decided. Oh, don't tell me the numbers are some satanic magic or something, right? Anyway. In effect. But so today, just like every Armistice Day, hopefully from now on too, I'm going to interview Jim Powell for you. He's a libertarian from the Cato Institute, and he wrote a book called Wilson's War, How Woodrow Wilson's Great Blunder Led to... Well, let me get the whole damn subtitle right here. Got it. It's right here. Led to Hitler, Lenin, Stalin, and World War II. And of course, the Cold War and the Terror War and the rest of it all. In fact, everything bad in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. So Jim Powell's going to come on the show, and he's going to convince you when he makes his case, because it's a pretty strong case, man. Yeah. I may overstate it a little bit, but he proves what he claims. Let's put it that way. And then our friend Ray McGovern is going to be here, and this will be interesting. We're going to talk with Ray for an hour. I think pretty much we should always interview Ray for an hour, because there's never enough time to talk with him about all the stuff he wants to say. But Ray has written about the recent news that President Bush 41, Senior H.W. Bush, has come out and denounced Cheney and Rumsfeld for hijacking his son's presidency and ruining it. Even though he does still blame Junior, it is Junior's fault, but it's their fault too. He's right about that. And so Ray wrote this really interesting piece for Consortium News where he went back over a lot of this history, some of which I didn't even know, a lot of which I did. But it's going to be about what George H.W. Bush did to try to stop the war and what he didn't do, the Iraq War too, I mean, and what he didn't do and how all that happened and what have you. And you know that Ray, he's a bright guy. And he used to know H.W. Bush because in the 1980s when H.W. Bush was the vice president, Ray was his morning briefer. Going over the president's daily brief. The early bird report, or whatever they call it now, or then. Briefing H.W. Bush. So, he knows him well, and I'm going to try not to get diverted into Latin America policy in the Reagan years, because I've had that conversation with Ray before. And you could go back and listen to it, you know, once the website's ever fixed, which it'll be fixed. I'm sorry the website's not fixed. It will be. So I don't think I'm going to say like, oh yeah, Ray, well, you must have been a bad guy in the 80s if you were CIA and briefing Senior. because that's going to be too far off topic. I want to talk about Iraq War II and Senior's relationship with Cheney and Rumsfeld and the neocons and all that. And it's pretty much a sure bet that Ray's going to have an hour worth of stuff to say. Hope you guys saw that article. We ran it the other day at antiwar.com. Anyway, I'm almost out of time because I almost forgot. Boy, don't forget this, Scott. Tim Frey is coming on the show in just a minute. So now I have to say this real quick. I saw Rand Paul last night, and yeah, he said a couple of good anti-war things, but it ain't enough. And he still is always trying to split the difference so bad that he's not really taking a brave stand on anything. Everybody can just sit there, listen to him for a minute, and then ignore him. I think Rubio got the best of him in a way that he could have never gotten the best of Ron. But Rand concedes the point, so many points, to his enemies before trying to say something even a little bit good. All just rings hollow now. It's all too little too late now. Boring the hell out of me. Anyway, that's all I have to say about that. Just not impressed. Somebody said, come on, Scott, you gotta admit he's better than any of the rest of them. So, okay, he's gone from negative a million to negative 999,999. Still worthless to me. He didn't change the debate at all, did he? He changed the conversation inside the Republican Party about what needs to be done with American military power or what doesn't? No. Hadn't made the slightest dent because he hadn't tried because he's horrible. Okay, now I'm done. And then the other thing I wanted to make fun of, other than Rand Paul, was this article in the New York Times today about how the European Union has now moved to label products that are made in the Israeli settlements in the occupied territories in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Or I don't know if East Jerusalem is included, but on the West Bank anyway. And they're being labeled. So these products are easier to boycott. And then the tweet this morning that they put out, that the New York Times put out about it, it's actually not in their headline. I better be in the actual article. I better make sure it's in the actual article and not just their quote, not just their tweet. Or else I'll just have to criticize their tweet. Well, geez. Is it? I'm searching for keywords here. Hang on. In the New York Times tweet, boy, did they get carried away. Oh, yeah, here it is. Michael B. Oren, they just didn't have the term yellow in there. Michael B. Oren, a member of the Israeli parliament, former ambassador to the United States, circulated a statement of condemnation with a photograph of the Nazi era showing a storefront painted with Jude, the German word for Jew, and a Star of David on it. Avigdor Lieberman, the ultra-nationalist foreign minister, posts on Facebook, each time Europe marks Jews is a sign that anti-Semitism, insanity, and hypocrisy has taken over will lead to disaster. Yes, it's the re-rise of the German Reich. Of the Nazi Reich, because what? Because they're labeling all things Jewish as being Jewish? No. Because they're labeling all products manufactured on Israeli stolen occupied territory as such. So that people can know that if they want to boycott it. That doesn't have anything at all to do with anti-Semitism. At all. And even better, it's laughable and ridiculous that this is all they've got. This is their only argument for any critic, and it happened to me all morning this morning on Twitter. Any critic of the occupation of the Palestinian territories and the deprivation of the Arab Christians and Muslims of their rights there. Oh, you're an anti-Semite then. Oh, we have a word for you. It's somebody who hates all Jews. Derp, derp, derp. But guess what? Everybody thinks that's stupid. Everybody just shrugs. Nobody believes in that. Except maybe other pro-Israeli Zionists who are already convinced. But everybody else just thinks that's stupid. Because it is stupid. Self-evidently. Yeah, boycotting the occupation is just like that time the Nazis took over Europe. Remember? Give me a break. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold the bumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it. And there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me too. Let the bumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's the bumpersticker.com at the bumpersticker.com. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, whatever. Libertarian foreign policy, mostly. Our first guest up today is Tim Frey. He runs Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc., which helps to sponsor this show and helps to sponsor the Liberty Radio Network. That's RRBI.co. Get it? That way, if you're raised on baseball, you can always remember because of the RBI thing in there. RRBI.co for Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. Welcome back to the show, Tim. How are you?
Hey, thank you for having me. I'm doing good.
Good, good. Been way too long since we've spoken.
It has been.
Good to have you on. So, man, you guys got a great thing going on here for Armistice Day, a deal to help support antiwar.com, which also helps sponsor this show, in a manner of speaking. Go ahead, tell them what's the deal.
Well, we're donating all profits from all sales through today to antiwar.com.
Good deal.
Well, that's a real good deal.
We sure appreciate that, no doubt about it. And so, what kind of metals are you brokering anyway?
Well, we do silver, which I like very much right now as a buy. Gold, of course, platinum, and palladium. So we sell all the silver eagles, silver maple leafs, bars and coins and that sort of thing. And then in gold, it's, the gold eagles, Krugerrands, maple leafs, all your favorites there, gold bars. So that, we're an in-hand precious metals dealer.
Mm-hmm.
You give us money, we give you gold.
Good deal. Well, I was on Ernie's show yesterday, and Ernie said, hey, Bitcoins are high and silver is low, and I'm on my way over to do business with Tim Frey right now.
There you go.
So all you guys holding Bitcoins right now, I saw it actually already started dropping back down a little bit, right?
Right, yeah. I think it's back down into the low 300s.
Really?
312.
Oh, that's quite a drop again, then.
Yeah, that's a big drop. It was $500 just a week ago.
Yeah. All right, well, y'all missed your big chance. No, still, silver's doing is how low compared to usual?
1439 right now. I mean, there's no usual price for silver. It's been as high as $50 back in 1980. It got nearly that high again in 2011. It goes through cycles, and I think this is a very low cycle. One of the ways that I like to, compare gold to silver as far as an investment strategy is I look at the price of gold divided by the price of silver. If I get a number that's, in excess of 30 or so, then it indicates that I should probably buy silver.
Hmm.
Back in 2008, when we had the financial crisis, we saw silver prices crash down into the, high $8 range at one point. And at that point, you could buy 80 ounces of silver, you could buy 1 ounce of gold. A lot of folks bought 80 ounces of silver.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2011, when both metals kind of reached a near, recent peak, that ratio dropped to less than 30 to 1. So we had people bringing us 30 ounces of silver and getting an ounce of gold when they could have only bought, an ounce of gold the day they bought the 80 ounces of silver. So it's kind of like a swing trade, a back and forth trade where you play the ratio game.
Mm-hmm.
It's been very good for some investors. So we're looking at silver today. It's over 70 to 1. It's probably 73 to 1 or 74 to 1 right now. So I'd buy 74 ounces of silver, sit back and wait for that number to drop, divide the price of gold by the price of silver. When that number starts to approach 30 or at 30, I maybe start thinking about trading.
Yeah, man, it sounds like I had to figure out how to try to make some money and learn how to do this myself.
Right, right.
Well, it must have worked, man.
Yeah. We have some investors also that do this with Bitcoin as well. They compare the price of Bitcoin and the price of silver and, start to do the calculations.
Good deal. All right, so tell me this. why would a guy like you, whatever you're like, be interested in supporting a thing like antiwar.com?
Well, I see a very close interconnection between war and banking. And I think the banking system, the money system worldwide really is just totally corrupt. We don't get value for our money and for our effort and our work. So I see the two so closely tied together, they're inseparable. We say banks drive war, really is what happens. The bankers create the wars, they profiteer off of that. And really at this point, we're watching the U.S. military around the world. So, you know, that is support of the dollar. That's how they keep the dollar going, is by having the mightiest force. And, I think that may come to an end very soon. I think people around the world, countries around the world are getting tired of our interventionist policies and, you know, the wars we're starting and the wars we're about to start. And so, you know, one of the ways they can defend themselves against that would be to give up the dollar. And when they give up the dollar, that's an awful lot of dollars that are going to come flying back into this country, which, you know, could very easily result in a hyperinflationary situation. It could be a very bad economic time.
Hey, all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Oh, crap. I'm sitting here asking an awesome question with the mic off because I'm an idiot. This happens from time to time due to my idiocy. I was asking a great question. It was something like this. My whole life I've heard that the national debt is too high. And yet apparently everybody in D.C. thinks, nah, we can keep printing money as long as we want. Money's no object. And recent history is proof of that. And so maybe they're right, because that massive hyperinflationary dollar crash hasn't happened yet. So what do you think?
Well, I mean, we've seen since the financial crisis, we've seen foreigners completely lose appetite for buying U.S. bonds, government bonds. They're not buying those. Those are being soaked up by the banks and the largest bank, the Federal Reserve Bank. So, I think we're already sort of seeing a beginning of the end. It's, you know, the snake eating its own tail. It's eventually going to, be a very bad circumstance financially as a result.
Mm. Yeah, it seems like that's the real drawback to the whole system, and the way they've got it set up is they've got enough bubblegum and string to keep the thing going so long that it sort of seems like the end will never come. That, you know, the doomsayers, they say doom. They must have been wrong, because look, here we are already in 2015 and dollars are still dollars. They're not what they were worth. They're not worth what they were 10 years ago, but it's
right.
But on a day to day basis, they mostly are. And so you're just supposed to factor inflation into your calculations as you do your business and move on. That's the conventional wisdom out of Newsweek and Washington, D.C. anyway, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they target a certain inflation, and I think they jockey the numbers so that they're somewhere close to that. But certainly we're seeing much higher inflation in things like food prices and energy, mm-hmm. Oil and gas is a little bit cheaper right now. But we do see it certainly in the commodities. We see, you know, an increase in price that's much higher than what they're stating that it is.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll tell you what, man, if I can ever figure out how to actually do the radio business and not just a radio show, then you will be the first to know when I start doing my investing. You got that for
sure.
Well,
we'll be right there with you, still supporting you at antiwar.com.
Right. All right. Well, thanks very much, Tim, for everything. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you for having me.
All right, y'all. That is Tim Frey. He's at Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. That's RRBI.co. All profits today, Armistice Day, go to antiwar.com.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network.
They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds. And I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday, and The Future of Freedom with FFF founder and president Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. ScottHorton.Liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at Darren'sCoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And whether you know it or not, our next guest is your hero. He wrote a book, two books, trashing both Roosevelt presidents. Isn't that great? Bully Boy and FDR's Folly. But then my favorite is Wilson's War. How Woodrow Wilson's great blunder led to everything horrible that happened since then, including Mao Zedong and George W. Bush and Barack Obama. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Good, good. Glad to be with you.
Very, very happy to have you here. Okay, so, long story short, you make the case in your book that World War I was wrapping up until big, stupid idiot Woodrow Wilson stepped in and ruined everything. How so?
Well, the Central Powers with Germany, Austria, and on the other hand, England, France, and their allies had a stalemate that was going since 1914 into 1917. 3 years they're stalemated, neither side able to impose its will on the other. And when the United States became involved on the Allied side, on the side of Britain and France, that enabled Britain and France to win a decisive victory, meaning they could dictate terms if they wished to the losers, Germany, Austria, and so on. And Wilson, the president at the time, assumed that he could control what the Allies did, he could control what the losers did, and he could control what the Congress did. And it turned out he couldn't control any of those things. Wilson gave a famous speech, his 17 points for a just resolution of the conflict, but he couldn't get his allies to agree with it because most of the fighting had been in France, and both France and England and Russia, for that matter, had Russia was also an ally until they dropped out of the war. But they had lost several million men, and that plus the territory that had been occupied, very heavily damaged during the war. The French were absolutely determined to avenge their suffering. They didn't care for a just settlement that Wilson was talking about. They just completely ignored that and proceeded, since they ended up on the winning side by a wide margin, they proceeded to dictate humiliating surrender terms to the Germans. So that was step one. Step two was, how did the Germans react? Well, they didn't just take it. They were angry. They had been told by their people, by the generals and politicians in Germany during the war, that they were winning. And so when it became obvious that Germany was having to surrender, it wasn't until then that they really hit home to the Germans that they were losing this thing and being humiliated to boot. So you had a lot of anger and disillusionment, and that's what Hitler very skillfully exploited to develop a political base. And that was worsened by the reparations that were demanded by the French and the British. And the Germans ended up figuring the easiest way to pay off the reparations, as well as to maintain a big welfare state that the Germans had, was just to print money. So they print money in one of the most famous runaway inflations, 1923-1924. And it ruined the middle classes, so it disillusioned all the people who had believed that if you work hard and save your money, you'll have a comfortable old age, you'll have security. And all that went out the window. There were many stories about people who bought war bonds before the war, Germans who bought German bonds before the war, or even Germans who bought war bonds to finance the war. All of that was supposedly to be for their retirement, but as a consequence of the inflation, you could buy a box of matches, or you couldn't even buy a loaf of bread with some of these bonds that were supposed to support them in their middle age. So the middle class was basically wiped out in Germany. And people were bitter and disillusioned. And when they're bitter and disillusioned, they'll support lunatics. So that was the beginning of that. And then, of course, during the Great Depression, Germans were even more disillusioned and bitter because you had 6 million Germans were unemployed, the banks were failing, and all of that had to do with a lot of the economic disruptions caused by the war that were not resolved during the 1920s, certainly not capable of withstanding the additional economic blows that hit during the 1930s. And so that's how Hitler got going. Now,
all right, now hold on. Let's get to Russia in a minute, but I want to go back over a couple of things here real quick, if we could. Which is that, first of all, I learned in school, in government school as a kid, that the Treaty of Versailles and the harsh conditions and the reparations after World War I helped lead to World War II. They never explain how much of the territory was stripped away. They mention the hyperinflation a bit, just to show you a lady with a wheelbarrow full of money. And a little bit of that. And I'm sure they don't teach this at all anymore, but this was in the 80s. And, but they certainly don't explain how it couldn't have been like this if Wilson hadn't got America in to tip the balance so far in favor of the Allies, which is, of course, the ultimate point there. But then also, I really like how in your book, you talk about how important it was that Hitler's entire shtick from the hyperinflation in the 20s all the way through to the rise to the actual rise of power in the 30s, that every speech began with the denunciation, like a ritual, of the traitors of 1918 who had signed the Versailles Treaty. And by the traitors, he meant the Democrats who had actually opposed the war, but who Woodrow Wilson, as you show in your book, had insisted must be the ones to accept the surrender. Not the German militarists who had actually got them into the war and fought the war, but he made the good guys accept the terms of surrender, forever delegitimizing them.
Right. Wilson insisted that the generals all resign or get fired, and he would only deal with what he called a legitimate government. Well, with the generals no longer in command, the civilian politicians were the ones who had the unenviable task of basically handing over the keys to the store. And actually, one of the chief politicians involved in this transition process, he was assassinated not long after that by Germans who were angry at the humiliating surrender, which they... when the smoke cleared, it was civilians who were holding the bag, so they were the ones who were facing the fire.
Right, and I think you write about in your book, too, about how it didn't just radicalize people into the Nazi movement. It radicalized a whole generation of German communists, which then itself helped push more and more people toward the Nazis in reaction to them.
Yeah, well, there are many interesting aspects of this.
Now we're at the break and can't even hear him.
The communists, Marxists, and utopian communists, so-called, believe in abolishing private property. None of those people, Lenin, Trotsky, none of those people had any idea what a socialist economy would look like, how it would work. They were talking about the stages of economic development, starting in primitive times, and then comes capitalism, and capitalism creates the proletariat, and the proletariat, which is mainly city, that's urban. They're thinking in terms of factory workers. There's going to be a dictatorship of the proletariat, and then then we're going to get to a communist regime, and there's going to be no private property, and then the government will wither away.
In other words, the devastation was so bad that reason had been completely obliterated as well, it sounds like. But wait, right. hold it right there, Jim. We're at a break here, and I don't want the live audience to miss too much of this. But so hold it right there, and we'll be right back.
Yep.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples, and email me, scott@scotthorton.org, for more information. See you there. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Jim Powell. He's the author of Bully Boy, about TR, the madman, lunatic, would-be dictator of the world. And then his second cousin, twice removed, or whatever, FDR's folly, president for life, FDR there. But we're talking about a guy who might as well have been a Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, for as harmful as he was for American interests, and how his getting America into World War I ruined everything for everybody ever since then. And Jim has explained how tipping the scales in favor of the British and the French and the Russians helped to give them such advantage over the Germans that they ended up leading to the creation or creating the groundwork for the rise of the Nazi Party and the Third Reich and Adolf Hitler's dictatorship and World War II from that end. But now we got to talk about Russia, because Russia, of course, was allied with France and Britain in World War I against the Germans. And I think, Jim, I'm trying to remember, wasn't it that Congress voted to join the war just 1 month after the Tsar had been overthrown by the mobs, and they had created this interim government, it's called now. I don't know if it was meant to be interim then, the parliamentary government of Kerensky, which lasted from March to October 1917, correct?
Correct, yes.
And then, so what's Woodrow Wilson got to do with the Kerensky government?
Well, Kerensky wanted to get out of the war. Yeah, I mean, the Russia was unprepared for the war that started in 1914. Russia was in the process. An industrial revolution had come to Russia, so it was in the early stages of considerable economic development, and there was a lot of reform going on. But it had just started, and when the war started, it did not have enough railroad capacity, both to send 1 million men to the front, to the Eastern Front, and at the same time to continue shipping food to Russian cities. So there was a compromise. A lot of the Russian soldiers who were sent to the front were sent without guns. And they were told that when your buddy is shot, you grab his gun. That's your gun. And, of course, a lot of people were upset that their sons were being conscripted and sent to the front without any guns. So the problems began from there, and you had corruption, and you had all kinds of other problems. So it was a catastrophic decision by the Tsar to get into for Nicholas II to get into the war. And by 1917, it was clear that that Russia was deteriorating. It had been stressed beyond the ability to hold things together. And Alexander Kerensky was going along with that situation as best he could. Now, he was not advocating that Russia leave the war. He was going along with the flow. You know, he's in a collapsing building and trying to figure out, is there anything he can hold up? Is there anything he can do about it? He's trying to hold the government together because the Tsar has already fled. And it's actually Lenin who starts demanding. Lenin was the Bolshevik was the only one who is demanding, who is campaigning, trying to exploit the clear desire of the Russians to get out of the war. He's promising peace, land, and bread. And most of the Russian soldiers were peasants. And so they're promising land for the soldiers. Soldiers can show up in all these different villages where there was land available. A lot of people have been killed. There was empty land. They wanted to get it back into cultivation. So by the summer of 1917, you had the peasants in the Russian army fleeing they were deserting by the thousands, the hundreds of thousands. I mean, they did not want to miss out on land. That's what they've always dreamed of owning, is land. So the Russian army is collapsing rapidly. Now, it's interesting that Lenin, summer of 1917, Lenin tried three times to gain power with a coup, and he was not successful. He failed three times. And it wasn't until October of 1917 that the Russian army was completely gone. So in that circumstance, the small number of Bolsheviks were able to seize power. And very quickly they started the Cheka secret police. Lenin authorized the Cheka, and the main purpose was to suppress opposition. Because the army wasn't a problem. The army was gone, but they had a lot of political parties. Most of them were socialist, but most of the demand in Russia was for a socialist coalition.
Yeah.
The Bolsheviks wanted exclusive power for them to use violence by any means that was politically necessary. So,
and did I get it right in my article, Jim, that Wilson had given them $325 million?
Well, Wilson was...
In order to stay in the war, basically?
Right. Before Kerensky was chased out in October by Lenin, as I said, he was trying to deal with everything happening, and one of the things that was happening was the British, the French, and the Americans were alarmed that Russia may be leaving the war, which was becoming a more obvious catastrophe for the for the Russians.
And they wanted to keep the Germans divided on two fronts, obviously, yeah.
Right. The British and the French and the Americans didn't want Russia to leave the war, and then that would enable Germany to send many of its troops to the Western Front and make things harder for the Americans, the French, and the British. So he bribed the the Kerensky government. Kerensky agreed to stay in the war because they desperately needed the money. And but the fact of prolonging the war really accelerated the collapse of the army during the summer of 1917. So
yeah, I mean, you really make the case very strongly in your book that if Wilson had not put together that money to bribe Kerensky to stay in the war, the soldiers, with or without guns, with or without very many of them, at least they would have been around to protect the new regime from the communist overthrow. But well, they weren't. They were out starving on the front.
Summer of 1917, Lenin tried three times to pull off a coup, and he could not do it because even though the Russian army was collapsing as peasants were deserting by the hundreds of thousands to try to get the land that was being offered, even that remnant of the Russian army was enough to prevent the takeover by Lenin. He couldn't take power till October when the Russian army was completely collapsed.
Yeah. All right. So, Jim, you're saying intervention can be problematic?
It is very difficult to predict what is going to happen with many things, and certainly with how other people react to things that we do. The more we intervene, the more the more instability we can cause, because we have no control over how other people react. We can control what we do, maybe, but we cannot control and often overestimate our ability to control how other people react. And so in this case, you're talking of, in the whole case of intervening in the First World War, you're talking about we could not control how the allies, our own allies, reacted. And as I said, they went from a stalemate to dictating the peace. And the Treaty of Versailles specified, among other things, that Germany was exclusively responsible for the war and had to pay all the costs of the war, and all that. Wilson was completely powerless once we made it possible for the British and the French to have a decisive victory by virtue of our intervention. And we could not control how the Germans reacted, and we could not control what happened after that. But once we intervened and enabled the British and the French to be on the side that could have a decisive victory to break the stalemate, that's basically where Wilson lost control. Hello?
Oh, sorry, mic off. And you know, the same thing, you look at Iraq in the early part of this century, where not only did they overthrow Saddam, which was bad enough for destabilizing the place, but then they made sure that there would not be a negotiation between the old power and the new power by just taking the side of the Shiite majority and then waging a 5-year civil war for them in order to drive all the Sunnis out of Baghdad and make it a almost 100% Shiite city now. And then the reaction to that among especially the Saudis and other parts of the American government that are more pro-Saudi and didn't mean for things to turn out that way, where they handed southern Iraq to Iran, they just turn right around and start backing the Mujahideen in order to undermine Iran's position in Iraq and in Syria, and leading ultimately to the rise of the Islamic State. And we're going to be dealing with the consequences of George Wilson Bush's intervention for the next 100 years, just like Bush was actually going in, screwing around, messing with the consequences from 100 years before.
Yeah, it was certainly a mistake to get involved in dictating the borders of a lot of different countries, certainly including Iraq, where you had a Sunni majority and a Shiite minority, where there happened to be oil fields, and then the Kurdish areas up in the north. So these people had never been in a national government before where they had to get along and so on. So we had no control over that. And a related case, of course, is what happened in Iran, where we, back in the early 1950s, helped the Shah gain power, confirm his power, and everything was fine for a while, but then the Shah in the 1960s, actually earlier than the 1960s, but he started to develop an authoritarian regime that was secular. And the secular part of it especially inflamed radical Muslims in the 1960s, and Ayatollah Khomeini became an enemy of the Shah's as early as the 1960s. And so our friend the Shah, who helped us during the Cold War by keeping Russians out of the Middle East, our buddy becomes, had enemies in the radical Muslims. So we became their enemies, or they became our enemies. And you end up with the taking of American hostages in 1979, and the what went on there, and then we went on to back Saddam Hussein in the early 1980s when he went to war against Iran. So we had two reasons for the Iranians to be hostile and start focusing on us.
Yep.
So now here we are, and there aren't any easy things that can be done about it.
Yep. And so it goes on and on. Hell, right now we're fighting on both sides of the war. We're still fighting for Iran's position in Iraq while we're fighting for Al-Qaeda's position against them in Syria. We're fighting for and against Al-Qaeda at the same time in Yemen right now, as Saudi's backing Al-Qaeda against the Houthis, and we're helping them. At the same time, we're still drone striking them.
No,
so I don't even think Hitler could figure that one out.
Yeah, well, One of the hardest things in foreign policy is to manage the transition from heavy intervention to lesser or non-intervention, to manage that process, go from where you're constantly intervening in an unpredictable, often unpredictable ways, To go from there to a non-interventionist foreign policy is extremely difficult. Obama's approach to that has been to walk away from it. And that doesn't work out very well, because there are people in the world who are aspiring dictators, terrorists, and so on.
Wait, where did he walk away from?
What's that?
Where did he walk away from? Not Yemen or Somalia or Pakistan or Libya or Syria or Iraq.
Oh, he's trying to walk away from intervention. He's just saying, I'm not interested. I'm not participating in this anymore. I mean, he has gone back on some of that. He's announced that we're going to be in Afghanistan longer than he had said. He hasn't done anything in Syria.
Oh, come on now, Jim. Where you been the last 4 years? He's been backing Al-Qaeda suicide bombers in Syria against Assad for Turkey and Saudi and Israel this whole time.
Right. He's going back and forth. He's saying, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm pulling out. And so then he gets forced. After a lot of resistance, he gets forced into...
Well, it's true the PR is different from the reality, but don't mistake that for the policy flip-flop.
He's one of the world's worst negotiators. So, if you're trying to get to a non-interventionist position, you need more sophistication than simply saying, I'm going to walk away And
I disagree totally. I think your premise is all wrong. Your premise is all wrong. He hasn't walked away. If he had walked away, it would be totally different. Instead, what he's done is train proxy armies and send in, work with the Saudis and send in Mujahideen.
And shooting, you know, he's killing people with drones.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like he's Ron Paul. If he was Ron Paul, that'd be a different discussion. And you could say, well, withdrawal has led to this. But he hasn't withdrawn. He's expanded the war in Afghanistan. He doubled down in Afghanistan with the whole surge, expanded. Ended the drone wars in Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, overthrew Gaddafi, and this is not a non-interventionist president walking away from anything. I mean,
he did pull
troops out of Iraq, but that was on Bush's timetable.
He has no interest in it, so his ideal is to walk away from it. Well, you know, there are other people who rush in to take advantage of it.
Well, I just wish that were true, is all. Anyway, listen, I'm sorry, Jim. I really appreciate your time today, but I'm way over time here and got to go. But
okay,
thanks
great.
Very much. Appreciate it. That's the great Jim Powell, everybody. And his books are just great. It's Wilson's War, Bully Boy, and FDR's Folly. And we'll be right back. Oh, and we are back. That's how over time I was. Oops. Yeah, well, I'm terrible about the hard breaks, everybody. I admit it. Terrible about the hard breaks. Got a great interview out of Jim Powell there, though. I do hope you guys will read his book, Wilson's War. It is a frustrating thing, I'll tell you. I mean, it's well written. I'm not saying it's frustrating that way. It's frustrating in just how accurately it portrays the situation. Now, I'm really just stalling for time here because I got to get Ray on the line. Oh, bear with me, Ray McGovern. I'm coming. It's, there he is. Oh, and his symbol is yellow. Oh, damn you, Skype. I don't like you, Skype. All right, guys. I'm going to have to find some audio to play for you here. So that then I can get him on the gutting line here. Syria, Biden, how about that?
Our allies in the region were our largest problem in Syria. The Turks were great friends. The Saudis, the Emiratis, etc. They were so determined to take down Assad, they poured hundreds of millions of dollars and tens, thousands of tons of weapons into anyone who would fight against Assad. Except that the people who were being supplied were al-Nusra and al-Qaeda.
We have to choose the lesser of evils here. The lesser evil is the Sunnis over the Shiites. It's an evil, believe me. It's a terrible evil. Again, they've just taken out 1,700 former Iraqi soldiers and shot them in a field. But who are they fighting against? They're fighting against the proxy with Iran that's complicit in the murder of 160,000 people in Syria. You can just, you know, do the math. And again, one side is armed with suicide bombers and rockets. The other side has access to military nuclear capabilities. So from Israel's perspective, you know, if there's got to be an evil that's going to prevail, you know, let the Sunni evil prevail.
This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out seven countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran.
I've ordered military action in seven countries. I have ordered tens of thousands of young Americans into combat.
Isn't that funny though? Number seven there. Seven countries the neocons wanted attacked, and seven countries Obama's attacked. I actually was just having a conversation with Jim during the break there that you guys missed, where he sounded like a Republican talking about how Obama's been withdrawn from the Middle East and doesn't really have an interest in it and is not doing a responsible withdrawal. And, you know, like he's some kind of non-interventionist like he pretended to be for a minute in 2007. You know, anyway. That was kind of funny. Anyway, here he is again.
I've ordered military action in seven countries.
Yeah, that's not non-interventionism, see. That's interventionism. Okay, anyway, running late, but now to our good friend Ray McGovern. He's writing at consortiumnews.com. He used to be a CIA analyst for 27 years. Now he's the co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, which often writes memos to the president about what he ought to stop doing. And that's this president and the one before him, too. I don't know if they go back all the way to Clinton years. Anyway, So he's a peacenik. He works, or not works, but he gives speeches through an organization called Tell the Word, which you can look up. They're based in D.C., a church group, and they'll have him out to give a speech about peace to you and yours over there. And did I say writes for consortiumnews.com? And this one's very long and very interesting. Bush 41, that is H.W. Bush, that is senior, finally speaks up on the Iraq War. And you know what? I should remember how young this audience is. Bush Sr. was president from 1989 through 1993, everybody. Okay, good. Hey, welcome to the show. How you doing, Ray?
Good, Scott. And you?
I'm doing good. Very happy to have you here. Very happy to read this article and learn a lot of the things that I learned in here about, well, the march to war in 2002 and 2003. Into the current chapter of America's Middle Eastern madness there. And now, so the thing of it is that H.W. Bush just made news because in his new book coming out that the New York Times got their hands on, he says, you know, Cheney and Rumsfeld ruined my son's presidency, but yeah, of course it is his fault for hiring them and doing what they said, but still it is their fault. And everybody knows that that's absolutely correct and in both senses there. But you had quite a reaction here and really got into telling the story about the split between the father and the son and the split, for that matter, between the oil men and the neocons when it came to Iraq War II. So do tell, sir, please.
Well, Scott, that's a good lead-in. The fact that Bush the Elder decided to let it all hang out with his biographer, John Meacham, in a book that I get tomorrow, at the quickest I could get it. It's sort of been released to the Times and other, you know, Hoya or Aristoi people, the what my grandmother used to call the upper crust. But there was enough released in these reports to really give me a very sad flashback. Let me explain. When George W. Bush came into office, and, you know, right after 9/11, when he had a chance to play to our best or our worst emotions and chose the latter, it was clear that the people that he had brought into office were really egging him on to war. Now, that was first and foremost Cheney. Everybody could see that. And Rumsfeld and their whole bunch of other people, the so-called neocons. Paul Wolfowitz, for example, who at last mention has been advising Jeb Bush's campaign. Yeah, he was lusting for war against Iraq. So what I did since, George H.W. Bush was a friend of mine, okay? I used to brief him. I worked directly under him when he was head of the CIA. And after he and I both left government, we had a correspondence. He's a very congenial person. And when you're friends, you exchange emails, or in our case, it was hard copy letters. And I took it so seriously in early January of 2003, when it was very clear that we were going to go to war, I wrote him a note, and I said, Mr. President, you know, I'm emboldened by the memories we had together to ask you privately if you could just tell your son about the crazies. Now, for your audience, they need to know who the crazies are. They're the ones I just mentioned, the Richard Perls, the Paul Wolfowitzes, the ones that are called neocons, and one definition of neocon is for those who cannot really see any separation between the U.S. interests and those of Israel. Israel was also applauding us for going to war against Iraq. So those are the folks that that George H.W. Bush, the elder, had to contend with, and I watched them, okay? Now, he couldn't fire them because they were, you know, he would have incurred the wrath of what in those days passed for the Tea Party people, the real hardline folks, and he didn't want to have a stir up with the Republicans. So he kept them in places in the Pentagon and elsewhere where they couldn't get us into major trouble, okay? He had James Baker, his Secretary of State. He had Brent Scowcroft, a very experienced National Security Advisor. And they were the ones that were calling the shots, and they succeeded in keeping the Wolfowitzes and the Pearls and the others down in the bowels of the Pentagon and elsewhere. So why all this background? Well, when W came in, he brought these guys with him. And not only that, but after watching this for almost a year, I decided, you know, hey, McGovern, you have this personal relationship with the guy's father, for God's sake. Yeah, you run a risk of losing this personal relationship. But we're talking about war here, okay?
Yeah, all right, now hold it right there. I hate to do this, but we're going to do like the cliffhanger at the commercial break. When we get back, we're going to find out what George H.W. Bush said in his response to Ray McGovern. This is a breaking story right here on the show today. The first I think anybody's ever heard this publicly about Ray's attempt to get George H.W. Bush to speak out against Iraq War II before it was too late. It's the Scott Horton Show. Hang tight. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment, MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to MPVEngineering.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson, Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. It's Armistice Day, 2015 here, doing the Scott Horton Show, and I've got an exclusive for you. I'm talking with Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst for 27 years. He was the morning briefer for Vice President George H.W. Bush in the Ronald Reagan years and had a personal friendship with him on some level, and we all know, we remember the history, don't we, guys, everybody, that in 2002, Ray and his merry band of veteran intelligence professionals for sanity were desperately putting out press releases, memos contradicting the fake intelligence, saying that, no, Saddam did not just receive a bunch of weapons of mass destruction as manna from heaven, because, and we know what he doesn't have from the last 10 years of inspections. So this is a bunch of lies and we got to try to stop it. And they really did their very best, led by Ray at the time, to do so. But now, so Ray is telling the story of how he took advantage of his personal relationship with former President George H.W. Bush and wrote him a letter in, I think you said, very early 2003, before the war, saying, Mr. President, don't you think you ought to at least educate your son about who the crazies are, right? Because George W. Bush was probably as confused as every Democrat in the country trying to tell one kind of Republican from another. And, I mean, hell, everybody thought it was James Baker and the oil men wanted the war all along in the first place. Who ever heard of a neoconservative? Who ever knew that there was a faction of 40 men in D.C. and New York who put the interests of a foreign power first and win, and can win like this when they're allied with the vice president, etc.? It's clear, and Andrew Coburn has reported, that Junior never even asked Senior what is a neocon until 2006. Ray, six. It's a good thing I don't have a gun. I might shoot myself in the head. He didn't even ask. And even then, Andrew Coburn, the way he reports it is, Senior merely said to him, who or what? And so he said, what? And Senior said, Israel. Like, both of these idiots, like, they can't even have a conversation at all. Like, Senior can't even take the time to say, it's Pearl and them. Junior, come on, dummy. You know? I don't know. So go ahead, tell your story. I'm sorry I'm talking so much, but go ahead and tell the story of what you wrote in this letter to Bush Senior here.
Sure, Scott. Can you hear me okay? We're on Skype now, I guess.
Yes, you're just fine. Please go ahead.
All right. Well, I want to make it very clear that I did take advantage, as you put it, of our friendship, that is, between the elder Bush and me, to try to warn him about what was going on. Now, it's really important for me that people realize that I'm not going to divulge or even talk about in any way the way we got together when I briefed him every other morning on the president's daily brief. That is sacrosanct. I'm never going to release any information from that because obviously I don't want to prejudice things for my successors. There should be a complete confidentiality there. So I'm not betraying any secrets from that time. What I'm saying is that we were friends. When my youngest son graduated from William & Mary, George H.W. Bush was the main speaker, and he had us over to where we were staying, my wife and Joseph, my son, and it was for half an hour. We had a wonderful meeting. That was after he was president. That was 20 years ago. That was after I had quit as well. So what I did was get very upset with the fact that, number one, people like Richard Pearl were threatening to use nuclear weapons on Iraq. Now, I kid you not, go back to the record. That's what they were saying. And I said, my God, you know, these people really deserve the label crazies. And so I did write this letter. It was early January 2003. And I said, you know, I'm really upset with the cavalier way that the pearls of this world, I call them the pearls of the Pentagon, how they're promoting the use of nuclear weapons as an acceptable option on Iran. I mean, on Iraq. Freudian slip here. You know, I said, the fact that these people have the president's ear, you know, is really scary, downright scary, I said. And I think he needs to know why you exercise such care to keep them at arm's length. You know, they're also leaning all over my former colleagues, CIA analysts, to make sure their analysis will, quote, justify, end quote, this war. That's you know what that's like. You're ahead of the CIA. That's also unacceptable. And so I said, you know, I've become so upset about this that I've started to publish op-ed pieces, and we're about to establish veteran intelligence professionals for sanity to speak out on these things. And so I'm going to.
Oh, then I got the date wrong. You wrote this letter in early 02, not early 03.
No, it was early. Did I say 02? It was early 03, actually.
Oh,
it was,
well, no, but you created veteran intelligence professionals for sanity before that in 2002, didn't you?
Well, it actually didn't take formal shape until January of 2003.
Oh, I'm sorry, Ray. I'm confused and interrupting. Please go ahead here.
No, we were just exchanging a lot of emails and giving each other sanity checks all throughout 2002. In 2003, we decided to incorporate ourselves, so to speak, and our first memo was on the day that Colin Powell made that speech at the UN.
I see.
So suffice it to say that I had been writing, and I enclosed four of my op-eds. Now, these were not in New York Times or the Washington Post, ha, ha, ha. They were in, like, the San Francisco Examiner or the Charlotte Observer or the Hartford Courant or the Miami Herald. I mean, these were no slouch newspapers, but hardly the tools of the people running things. So one thing I called a specific attention to was one I had just done, 1 week before on January 3, it was in the Charlotte Observer, and it talked about Vietnam and how LBJ buffaloed. LBJ intimidated everyone into going up to Congress to sell the Tonkin Gulf Resolution. Now, for your listeners who are a little younger, there was one real incident in the Tonkin Gulf where the North Vietnamese took shots at our destroyers, and then there was a contrived incident 2 days later. The contrived one was used to justify the so-called Tonkin Gulf Resolution, which in turn, quote, justified, end quote, the war in Vietnam for the next many years, okay? So what happened? When we told McGeorge Bundy, this national security advisor, that it was all bogus, that the NSA had all screwed up, that there was no attack on the 4th of August, LBJ comes in. Now, how do I know this? I know this because when McNamara wrote that book, there used to be a McNeil-Lehrer report, and they used to ask real questions then. So they had McGeorge Bundy, and they had others, McNamara, around the table. And they said, well, what happened that morning, that next morning? You knew it was a bogus attack. And McGeorge Bundy says, well, the president came in, and he's a very big guy. And he said, okay, now we can sell that resolution up on the hill. Go up there, Mac, and sell the resolution. And I said, Mr. President, there's some doubt as to what happened.
Yeah, never you mind that. All right, wait, I got to interrupt you here, Ray, and we got to go to this break again. We're hearing about what Ray told Bush Sr., and we're about to hear what Bush Sr. said back right after this, y'all. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Talking with the heroic Ray McGovern about his attempt to get George H.W. Bush to do something to stop his son from launching the aggressive war against Iraq in March 2003. And he wrote this letter and he brought up the crazies who, you know who I'm talking about, Mr. President, Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz and their friends working for Dick Cheney, and brought up the Gulf of Tonkin resolution and LBJ's bullying of the intelligence establishment and the cabinet to go along with his decision to have a war. And then, so what did Bush Sr. say to you, Ray?
Okay. First, I have to disavow being heroic, Scott.
Oh, please, give me a break. No, stop talking about that and answer the question.
Just doing my job then, and I'm doing my job now.
All right.
I want to reassure you that I'm not engaged in a filibuster here. What I need to do is set the stage for the response that I got from the former president, George H.W. Bush.
Sure.
And let me just pick up where I was leaving off on the Gulf of Tonkin thing. What McGeorge Bundy said to McNeil and Lehrer just stood my hair on end. He said, well, you know, I said that the evidence was not so clear about whether there was an attack yesterday. And the president just turned on me, and he's a big guy, you know, LBJ. And he said, Matt, are you going up there on a hill to sell this resolution or are you not? McNeil, what did you do? Well, I went up the hill to sell the resolution. Now, why do I say that? Because there are people who, out of ideology, out of cowardice, out of careerism, I mean, McGeorge Bundy had been dean at Harvard, for God's sake. He's not going to be out in the street. So why did he do that? I don't know why, but that's what we saw later when the intimidator was not the president, but the vice president, Dick Cheney. Now, after Larry Wilkerson, chief of staff of Colin Powell during this whole thing, was asked by several congressmen at a formal hearing, how did this all go down? How is it possible that the bureaucracy was completely escaped, that they completely overrid everything? And Larry Wilkerson says two words. No, I'll say three words. The vice president. Okay, now no one was in a better position to know that. In any case, I had written this thing up a week before I wrote this letter, and I enclosed a copy of this thing, which was titled Drift Towards War Revives the Nightmare of the Tonkin Gulf in Vietnam. And that leads me to the response I got from the senior Bush. He says, Dear Ray, it is only meet and right that you speak out. Wow. Here I am ranting and raving about this unnecessary war coming up, and I get, it's meet and right that you speak up. He says, thanks for your letter. Please do not worry that, quote, crazies, end quote, have any influence on POTUS 43, which means President 43, Bush 43. I will admit that early reporting indicated that, but it wasn't true then, and it's not true now. Okay, well, that's what he said. That's hopefully what he actually believed, but there's no gainsaying the fact that as he watched things develop, he realized that Cheney and Rumsfeld, which he now admits, had inordinate pressure, inordinate influence on his son, if only because, the young Bush styled himself, well, actually, he bragged about it several times. I am the first war president of the 21st century. Now, it doesn't take much to play on that instinct and get him to fashion an unnecessary war, especially when you have a guy like Cheney who, made detours all around the bureaucracy, leaned on my fellow analysts in the CIA to perjure themselves, okay, to concoct evidence. And now, of course, Cheney is completely unrepentant. He says a war was necessary, and besides torture, well, he didn't say torture. He said waterboarding, I'd do it again in a heartbeat. And what is Bush, young Bush?
A man without a heartbeat says that, too. That's
torture,
funny.
Right? And young Bush, when his exit interview, when he was still president but just about to leave for the West, he was asked, did you have any regrets? And he, strokes his cheek and he said, well, yeah, it was that mistaken intelligence on Iraq. Now, please, listeners, please know that that was the last and most grievous lie. The intelligence was not mistaken. It was fraud. It was out and out fraud, and it pains me to this day that my former colleagues let themselves be suborned into concocting, into fabricating, into forging the kind of evidence that the president and vice president and secretary of defense used to, quote, justify this terrible war, which has had the incredible consequences that we predicted, actually, and that we now see, without any taking pride in our prediction, all over the Middle East and not just in Iraq. So this was a cataclysmic thing. And to have been, I'm glad I tried. I'm glad I tried at that time because I wouldn't be able to live with I didn't try in Vietnam. I saw some of the skullduggery that was going on in Vietnam. I didn't have the courage to speak out then. In other words, one of the lessons here, Scott, is that there is no whistleblower protection for people in the intelligence community. Now, I know 5 or 10 people still working there who knew this was absolutely wrong and didn't have the courage or didn't have the incentive or didn't feel they would be protected if they went to James Risen or someone like this and said, this is a crock. We're being made to fabricate intelligence. So that's really one of the lessons here. There were, I would say, 100 people in my former analysis division of the CIA who knew exactly what was going to happen, and nobody spoke out. 3 Foreign Service officers, Ann Wright, Bradley Keesling, and John H. Brown, quit before the war because they could see from their perches in Mongolia and Greece and at Georgetown University how blatantly illegal and based on false pretenses it was.
Well, and there were a lot of generals that resigned too, but they retired. They didn't make a stink about it and resign out of principle. They just sort of
Name one general like that. That's my other beef here. I mentioned General Zinni, okay?
Yeah.
Now, Zinni, he's got a good rep. Still, he has good rep. But he was sitting there. He was sitting there on August 26th, 2002, when Dick Cheney set the terms of reference for war.
Oh, and this is not just some general with a name that you never heard. This is the head of Central Command. This is the American commander of the Middle East.
Yeah. And as I say, he had a good rep up till then, and he was getting an award at the Veterans for Foreign Wars thing there in Nashville. And so he's sitting right next to Cheney. And Cheney, of course, talked all about the weapons of mass destruction that Saddam Hussein had, and that he was about to get a nuclear weapon, and that don't don't be sucked into thinking that UN inspectors can help, because that will just give you a false sense of security. We know that Saddam is too clever. He will, he laid it all out there. Had he told Colin Powell, the Secretary of State? No. Had he told George Tenet, the head of CIA? No. Where was George W. Bush? Cleaning brush out there in Crawford. Okay. So this was a preemptive move, typical of Cheney, even though, Andy Card later said, you don't market a new product in August. Well, the hell with that, said Cheney. And why did he say that? Because George H.W. Bush's friends and cronies and statesmen like James Baker, mm-hmm. who had his head screwed on right, Brent Scowcroft, the National Security Advisor.
Wait, hold it right there. Hold it right there. That's where we're going to pick up this conversation on the other side of the break, y'all. It's Ray McGovern, and this is a very important part of the story, Cheney's VFW speech in August and the preemption of the rest of Bush Sr.'s men, as Sr. once thought Cheney was. We'll be right back with Ray McGovern in just a sec, y'all. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Okay, guys, we're talking with Ray McGovern, veteran intelligence professional for Sanity, former CIA analyst, former morning briefer for Vice President George H.W. Bush in the Reagan years. And we're talking about his correspondence with H.W. Bush in early 2003 in a last-ditch attempt to try to influence the president, the former president, to try to influence his son, the president, to put the brakes on and not start an aggressive war against Iraq. And I think Brent Scowcroft's article, Don't Attack Saddam, that he wrote for the Wall Street Journal, is pretty famous. But I have to admit, I was kind of surprised. I guess I remember Eagleburger's name floating around a little bit, but you really have you memorized or wrote it down somewhere, all of George H.W. Bush's men who came out on a very obvious, deliberate campaign to speak for the father in August of 2002, but maybe they should have waited and debuted their product after Labor Day, like in Andrew Card's advice, because as you say, Dick Cheney ran out and gave a speech and stomped him down, and that was the end of that before Junior even got back from his vacation. But so anyway, please, even Henry Kissinger, Ray, tell the story.
Yeah, well, Scowcroft was a leadoff batter, August 4, Henry Kissinger, August 12. Kissinger says unilateral attack will set dangerous precedent. Then we have Scowcroft on the 15th saying, don't attack Saddam on the 25th of August. We've got James Baker. Okay. Now, he has a long op-ed in the New York Times. And it was, of course, the next day that Cheney spoke out on the 26th in Nashville at the Veterans for Foreign Wars. Chuck Hagel was complaining about the stupidity of what was about to happen. And I think most interesting, Dick Armey, who was the Republican majority leader in the House at the time, he complained later that the only reason he voted for the war was that he bitterly complained that he had been BS'd, the whole word there, by Cheney. So what Cheney needed to do was to stanch the juggernaut toward peace, and he successfully did that with Bush out of town. 5 days later, Bush comes back. The die is cast. The propaganda offensive at the so-called White House Iraq group mm-hmm. is full in sway with Karl Rove and Matlin and all these people ready to. And sure enough, on the 8th of September, the big guns came out, with Tony Blair having been briefed the day before at Camp David, And that's when we got the aluminum tubes. What did they do?
Wait, can I stop you for a second before the aluminum tubes? Because I love this story and I want to hear all this, everything from there to March. I want to hear it. But can I just mention the supreme cynicism of Dick Cheney to give this speech to the last veterans of World War II and Korea and Vietnam and telling them, and even Desert Storm for that matter, and telling them they have to give up their grandsons and sons, great-grandsons in many cases, to go fight this crusade, when this man, Dick Cheney, above all of them, knew he was lying right to their faces, this coward?
Yeah. I can't account for that, why he would do that. And, of course, that's the big question. And
Because you're questioning them if you question their applause for him, basically. He's hiding behind them, in other words. Just like Bush did with his constant, you know, pseudo-army jackets and soldiers draped behind him. How can you criticize that? He might as well be wearing an American flag suit.
Well, Scott, as you know better than most, the most important facet here, in my view, is the total cheerleading that the mainstream media was engaged in for war. That's even more difficult for me to explain, but we lost our free media somewhere along the line, and there was no questioning of Dick Cheney, what he said. Oh, God, this was terrible. We have to go to war. And so he had carte blanche to do this. And
in fact, on the previous point there, Ray, about the all of Senior's men, Scowcroft, Baker, Eagleburger, all these guys coming out, was there any break in the media at all at that time that said, wow, these men are clearly speaking for the father here? I mean, obviously Bush Sr. is not going to write an op-ed against the war. But there's no way that these men are talking out of school like this unless Bush Sr. called them and asked them to do it.
Well, you know, how they handle that?
How did they handle that?
They're very clever. They said, well, you know, it's not clear whether they're speaking for George H.W. Bush or not. You know, do you think they are? No, maybe. In other words, they diverted the essence of the dispute into whether or not the father had approved this.
And but the thing is, the answer is obvious, that absolutely, yes, he did order them to do it. And that makes it even more important what they said, that this is the father telling his son that you're letting people manipulate you into doing the wrong thing, dummy.
Yeah, but, you know, in a way, he should have said it himself. And what the
media
was saying is, speak for yourself, George. And they knew darn well he wouldn't speak for himself. He told me he was not going to say anything. You know, he's very chary about going public with respect to his son. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're sort of asking him to do a Kaczynski here. Remember him? His brother gave him up, you know? Ted Kaczynski,
Kaczynski, Unabomber.
Well, so, you know, are we our brother's keeper? Well, Ted Kaczynski's brother was. How about are we our son's keeper? It was just beyond him. He couldn't do it. And so the press eluded it by making it into a big conversation. Was he or wasn't he? Was George Bush behind this or not? And as you point out, hello, of course he was. But getting back to Cheney and Zinni, and this is really painful to say. So Zinni's sitting right there. He's going to get a blue ribbon or something, a new merit badge or something from the VFW, okay? And he listens, and later he says on Meet the Press, he says, you know, I couldn't believe this. I was shocked to hear Cheney say this. Why? Because I was back on contract. I was privy to all the intelligence on Iraq, and what Cheney was saying was not squaring with anything I said. Quote, there was no solid proof that Saddam had WMD. I heard a case being made to go to war, period, end quote. Guess when Zinni said that to Meet the Press? 3.5 years later. Now, you know, there are a lot of people who could have spoken out besides the people who wouldn't, the father. You know, I've just been thinking, Colin Powell knew damn well what was going on.
Yeah.
And he didn't speak out. Jack Straw, his counterpart in the UK, the Attorney General in the UK, Lord Peter Goldsmith, who issued an opinion say the war would be illegal just 10 days before the war.
Hey, for that matter, 150 million Americans who were against it before it started knew better too.
Yeah, but they kind of knew better, but they didn't have the evidence. Another guy who I'd mention is James Clapper. Now, what was he at the time? He was head of imagery analysis. In other words, all this satellite imagery. Where would you expect to find WMD? In satellite photography. So what was the word? You know, when Chalabi, that fellow from the Iraqi Revolutionary Council, was telling people, oh, there's a chemical weapons factory at these coordinates. Go check it out. And the imagery interpreter says, that's a crock. That's a chicken coop. Now, guess what? Clapper's instructions were, don't report chicken coops. If you can't report WMD, don't report anything. And there was nothing to report. It was all made up. If there were satellite photos, Colin Powell would have showed them at the UN on the 5th of February. So James Clapper sat on all this stuff. After it went down and there were no WMD, you know what he said? Oh, I think they went to Syria.
Yeah.
Now, he was cashiered, right? No. He's the director of national intelligence, has been for a couple of years, lied under oath to Congress, and he's still the director of national intelligence. So, you know, for services performed, that's where you end up, and that's how corrupt the intelligence setup now is.
And isn't that funny that we haven't heard anything from him about, see, Iraqi chemical weapons in Syria. We found them when we're in the process of destroying the Syrian chemical weapons. Nope, never happened. It was always
well, you know, I'm glad I don't have a shotgun.
These guys, man, well, they just get away with it, that's for sure.
No, no, that gun. In the end, we're going to get them. We're gonna spread enough truth around, Scott, you and I and others, and we're going to make them face into this. And this is the time to do it, because when Hillary voted for Iraq, she knew darn well what she was doing. She wouldn't let Scott Ritter, the chief UN inspector, into her office, even though he was a constituent, because she didn't want to hear there were no weapons of mass destruction.
Oh, yeah. And remember, of course, our current Vice President Joe Biden was the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who held one or two bogus hearings of all warmongers and then shut the whole debate down and led the Democratic Senate vote for it.
He wouldn't let us in the door either.
Man. All right, Ray, you're the best. Thanks very much for coming back on the show, as always.
Most welcome.
All right, you guys, everybody go read Ray McGovern at consortiumnews.com. Bush 41 finally speaks on the Iraq War. See y'all tomorrow.